Now, I would like to introduce this morning's presenter, and Gary presented part of our Ag and Uncertain Times series a year ago, and did such an excellent job, we thought we ought to bring him back. He's a professor, as I said earlier, at Montana State University, the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics. He's been at Kansas State University, and is now at Montana State. His teaching responsibilities include farm and ranch management, agribusiness management, finance, ag marketing, and he also has an applied research program. And applied research means that the research he does is really useful for those of us extension practitioners and producers in the field. And his applied research program includes livestock and grain risk management, international trade, agribusiness, and farm management issues. And he presently serves as the managing editor of the Journal of Agriculture and Resource Economics. Without saying any more, Gary, the program is yours. We will ask Gary some questions when his presentation is finished. Gary, the program is yours.
Thank you very much, John. Very, very kind introduction. I noticed the picture of me up in the corner. I'm not dressed like that today. I'm sitting here in my bunny slippers. Actually, I'm not. I'm right beside Duane Griffith's office, so I had to get rid of those this morning. Always nice to be invited back places. I'm often surprised to be invited back. I never know if it's because I did something well previously, or if nobody learned anything last time, so they're going to try again. So, John, I'm going to assume it was the former, not the latter, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to visit with the group today. I'm going to try to get this done, John, in about 20 minutes. Those who are friends of mine over there on the right, I see all the names out there. Some of these folks I certainly know. They'll tell you that I have trouble saying my name in 20 minutes, so we'll see if we can do a little better here today on the time. I wanted to follow this basic outline and talk briefly about each of these topics, and notice the concept or the ideas of price variability I have at the bottom as sort of a prelude into John Hewlett's talk following mine. I did enjoy the talk from Dan Sumner yesterday, and Danny, very good, and much of what I say actually feeds right off of some of their discussion about variability. What I wanted to do was give a discussion not only of variability, but talk first about sort of the cattle market situation, a little bit of history of where we've been, where we're heading, because I think that helps us understand a little bit about volatility as well. On my fourth slide, I often use this slide in outreach talks because it sort of shows a picture that Dan Sumner had mentioned yesterday. I have two lines here. The reddish brick line, brown line, is U.S. cattle inventories. We're down in around that 93 million head, numbers that we haven't seen, a low number that we have not seen since way before the 1970s. The green line represents production from those animals, and the title or the words U.S. beef production I have in quotation marks because this is meat obtained from these animals. In other words, I have extrapolated away from any import influences we might have had. And so with this a much smaller herd today, which you can see on the right-hand axis, if you follow across to the left-hand axis, we're producing about the same amount of beef from that herd as we did in the mid-1970s. So two things here. First of all, dealing with inventory numbers, as I mentioned, we're at 93 million head of all cattle and calves on farms, January 1 inventory. That's the level that we are at in the mid-1950s. So we see going back to 1867, and only Duane Griffith and John Hewlett were around to remember this, but we starting with data back at the Civil War time of 27, 28 million head. We've had a cattle cycle every 10 to 12 years on an increasing trend all the way to the mid-1970s. and then perhaps cattle cycles continuing, but on a declining trend in terms of numbers. And, of course, there is certainly some discussion, and I think research is warranted to ask the question, as we move through this decade and into the next, do we expect to actually see much in the way of cattle cycles down the road? Let me turn to the productivity aspect. How do we get so much meat from a smaller production herd? And one way to think about this, John Marsh, who retired a couple of years ago, out near your country now, John, and living in Cheney, Washington, or near there, we put together a graph that shows the productivity of our U.S. beef cow breeding herd. So what we have on this graph back into the 1970s, how much carcass weight of meat has been produced per beef breeding cow over the last, 40 years or so. And we can see, like much of production agriculture, this upward trend. This would be manifested in higher weaning weights, for example, but it's really a function of a number of things. Better nutrition and health, better genetics, improved management, more breed back, for example, fewer open cows, all those kinds of technological change that Dan Sumner talked about is really manifest in this little graph showing increasing technological change. Now, if we go to my slide, which I have numbered 7 now, what I want to show then is the price side of this equation. I've showed the quantity side. Let's think about prices a little bit. Here I've just graphed fed and feeder cattle prices in nominal terms. Dan Sumner mentioned this yesterday. This is the price that existed in that year back in the 1970s. Fed and feeder cattle traded for around early 70s, $30 per hundredweight. And as we move through time, we see this increasing trend, upward slope to these nominal prices. Here I have Nebraska 11-13 weight steers. And I've also graphed Montana, the pink line, Montana 500 to 600 weight steers. And so we see this upward trend in nominal prices. And of course, whenever I give this talk to producers in Montana and in the region, they quickly raise a hand and say, "Oh yeah, but we've had a lot of inflation," and that's precisely correct. If we take out the effect of inflation, as I have on slide 8. That's what I mean by real, and what economists mean by real fed and feeder cattle prices. I've just adjusted that data from the previous slide into today's dollars, which, of course, inflates the prices back in the 70s, and then we're back into prices that we're experiencing here in 2009 and 2010. And in this case, we see this downward trend, except for two spikes. Dan mentioned this yesterday. In fact, Dan mentioned a lot of this yesterday, which doesn't surprise me. Excellent speaker and an excellent economist. A downward trend in both fed and feeder cattle prices. Lest the livestock industry thinks they're being picked on, Dan mentioned the same kind of graphs for wheat yesterday, but all commodities. And we could extend that very easily into commodities like computers, commodities like calculators, commodities like oil to a great extent, where we have seen declines in real inflation-adjusted prices. So the decline in prices and the increase in productivity is certainly the story for commodities. To a great extent, this is why many agribusiness firms don't want to be in this type of an industry, because of the relative ease of entry and exit into being a wheat producer or a corn producer or even a cattle producer. My brother entered the corn production business 5 or 6 years ago. He's not a new farmer. He's been farming a long time. But he was able to say, look, here is a profit opportunity, and he started adding to the corn supply and taking away from raising malting barley. That entry and exit means that when there's profits, we expect to see entry. And so the competitive strategy of any agricultural producer involved in commodity production can only be that you can't affect price. All you can do is try to lower unit costs of production through technological change. And as a result, I actually have some data on the wheat market that shows if you look at the inflation-adjusted gross returns to an acre of wheatland in the U.S. since the Civil War time, the trend is absolutely flat. And that's because of entry and exit. We have technology that increases supply, and if supply increases faster than demand, which it has been, and as a consumer, we can all be thankful of that. This forces consumer prices lower. I like that. I'm a consumer. That process is the one that generates these lower inflation-adjusted prices. In the wheat market, since it's been going on since 1866, I'll go out on the limb and say that will continue for the next 50 years as well. Now, having said that, Dan showed very clearly that we have times when we're above that trend line, and there are times when we're below that trend line in terms of revenue and presumably in terms of profits as well. And that's the story of when people enter, when they're above that trend line, and when they exit. The key is to remember the trend line ultimately will determine long-run profitability. And the point of that is, again, I think it's always dangerous for people to look at record or close to record high prices and assume they're going to last forever. John, Dwayne, many of us have been around long enough. I think this is the fourth time where I've read in the Wall Street Journal that demand has finally outstripped supply, and we're going to see high prices forever. Four times I've heard that in the last 25 years, and every time it's been wrong. The ability to produce more is quite remarkable, and it's something that that we should actually be quite thankful for. Let me move on to slide 9 and talk a little bit then about domestic beef demand. While we have seen this reduction in cattle numbers and kind of a pretty constant level of beef production over the years, U.S. beef demand has actually declined by about 50% since the 1980s. My 2010 numbers from here on out are just projections. But the bottom line here, I'm not talking about per capita consumption. It's pretty easy to consume all we produce, just lower the price enough and people will buy it. But adjusting for price changes, what would we see in terms of actual demand for beef relative to 1980? This is an index. Don't worry about the numbers. Just look at the relative sizes. And basically, we've seen a pretty big reduction in beef demand in this country. And that's very troublesome to not only cattle feeders, but certainly to cow-calf producers. Another way to think about this is, why would it matter? I have a picture here, a little graph I put together on slide 11, where the numbers in the graph, in the figure, are not prices. They are years in which the prices on the left side occurred. And in the early 1990s, our total beef supply in the U.S. was somewhere between 25 and 26 billion pounds, and we had $75 to $80 fed cattle. In the late 90s and early part of this decade, we had 29 to 30 billion pounds of total beef supply, and we had prices that were hovering in that $65 to $70 per hundredweight figure for fed cattle. Now, something quite remarkable happened then. In the latter part of this decade, I guess actually starting in about 2003, is that I've got a purple line up there that we found a way to have 29 to 30 billion pounds of beef being produced, and yet it was being sold at fed cattle prices in the $85 to $95 range. And the only way that can happen is through increases in demand. And in fact, we did see an uptick in both domestic demand for beef about that time or just preceding that, and certainly in export demand as well. Now, my concern is that with the given recession, and I'm on slide 12 here, with the given recession we've had, I was concerned at the start of this year that the blue line might be what we're looking at in terms of demand, that it actually had shifted down because of recessionary things. If that's the case, and if we're going to produce 28 billion pounds of total beef supply, then we would have expected prices in the coming year. I've got 2011 at $85. I'm going to back up one slide, is that, you know, it looks like because of really strong export markets, even though our domestic market is flat, maybe we're still at the place where we can take 28 billion pounds expected production next year and sell it near a dollar. Right now, the futures market for Fed cattle are suggesting that very thing. Let me back here to my screen and go forward a couple of slides and talk briefly about that issue of international trade. I had mentioned exports just a second ago. On the import side of things, back in the 1970s, we were importing the top line somewhere between 2 and 3 billion pounds of all from all sources, live animals converted to pounds and carcasses and ground beef and all the stuff we import, about 2 to 3 billion pounds. As we moved into this decade, we were closer to 4 billion pounds. Most of that increase coming from the green line, if almost tracks perfectly, of the increase, which is increase from Canada. As the Canadian industry expanded and had access, more access to our market through CUSTA and also NAFTA was just added in Mexico, we ended up getting 4.5 billion pounds in the middle part of the 2000s. Remember, we had pretty high cattle prices then, too, which attracted that meat here. Since the latter part of this decade, those imports have declined somewhat, and this is really a function, even though we have high prices right now, this is really a function of worldwide beef supplies being tight enough that world prices are quite high as well. And so there are places for beef to go, and we've had fewer imports because there's just a bit of a supply restriction out there right now. If we think about imports as a percent of all the beef we have in the U.S., that is, we produce beef, we import beef in various forms, and then we have to do something with that. We are either going to consume it in the U.S. or we're going to export it. We have about 10%, 12% perhaps, this is a projection, of our total beef supply is in the form of imports. In terms of exports, we had a similar story of increasing exports up to about 2.5 billion pounds earlier in the decade. The big drop, of course, was the U.S. BSE case and subsequent cases. And this year, our exports should be up about 20% over a year ago, which again speaks to my earlier comment. We export, we'll probably export close to 8% of our total beef supply this year. In terms of value, we import and export different things, including a lot of exports of edible and inedible offal and hides and all sorts of things that we don't even use in the U.S. Except for the BSE period, we generally export more value than we import. Price outlook will be actually quite quick. I'm trying to think about 2011 cattle prices. U.S. beef production is forecasted to be lower than again from a year ago. Our exports were likely going to be, all the data are not in, of course, but our exports are likely to be 18 to 20% higher this year relative to a previous year. Imports are actually lower, and again, one might be quick to say, well, we just have to export more than we import. We'll have high cattle prices. It's a world market, and the world market situation is such that there are places where people want beef, and they're not finding enough of it right now. And even though we have high prices now, there's not enough to get imports coming here. Much of that meat that's out there is staying in other places. Certainly, as always, economies and a variety of beef issues, including safety and nutrition and consistency and ID and all those sorts of things are going to be important not only next year but in years beyond. My final point here is that the September 11 feeder cattle futures market, which is very thinly traded right now, but right now it's trading at $1.19. I always look at the perspective of the Montana industry. For Montana, that suggests calves for next fall, 2011, with about a historical plus five basis out of Montana of more than $1.25. And for a little bit heavier calf, the 6 to 7s out of Montana, $1.16. Those are very strong prices from any particular perspective you want to come out at. So, and again, all of the research, John, you mentioned that I was a managing editor of the Journal of Ag and Resource Economics right now. As I see papers come in, both in my journal and in other journals, all of the research shows that we basically are virtually unable to do any better price prediction than using futures markets and adjusting by a basis that has occurred, perhaps the average, over the last 2 or 3 years, depending upon the research and the commodity. If we think about price variability for a minute, and I'll finish up here, John, let's take a look at what we mean by variability. I think all of us think that variability is worse today than it has been at other times, and so when Duane asked me to do this talk, it really was an opportunity for me to think about variability, to ask the question, is it worse, is it better, is it growing, is it shrinking? So the first thing I did was take a look at monthly feeder cattle cash prices. I went to Oklahoma City, 600 to 700 weight steers, and I graphed the monthly prices since 1973. And so you see some variability, as Dan Sumner said. We should expect that. It's that kind of an industry. Lots of fixed costs, asymmetric assets, production, and weather matter a great deal. If we think another way of thinking about variability, then, is to think about the ranges within any given year between the highest monthly price and the lowest monthly price that we see using the same set of data, we can see that in the 70s we had some ranges of $20 and $27 high to low. Throughout kind of the middle part of my data, we were around that $10 to $15 range in a year. And then in this decade, we have this sort of period here where we're back into that 20 to, at one point in 04, a $30 range of high to low. So perhaps there is some indication here of higher variability in the last decade. Now, having said that, we have to also realize that we are at higher average prices as well. I showed a figure on that a little while ago. So one way to think about this variability is compare it relative to the mean values. If you have $20 cattle, there isn't a lot lower they can go. If you have $120 cattle, there's a lot of downside that can be in there, and there's also some upside as well. So one way that economists, statisticians measure this is through coefficient of variation, where I take that variability we saw in the previous slide, and I compare it relative to the mean values. And in this case, it's clear that we've had variability. It's not clear that it's been worse. The point we're on the graph here is somewhere around 0.05 to 0.1. That's certainly not unusual. In fact, if you try to fit a trend line in there, I fit a linear trend. It didn't fit very well. I fit a quadratic. It didn't fit very well. This is a third-order polynomial that fit quite well, and if you think if that's the true trend line, which it may or may not be, it looks like we've been actually quite flat in terms of variability in the last decade and maybe a bit longer than that, actually. Another way to think about volatility is through what's called implied volatility by thinking about feeder cattle futures prices. And the options attached with them allow us to calculate implied volatility. And I think from this you can see there are times of quite a bit of volatility whenever we hit these high spikes. Maybe the last year or two you'd say, hey, you know, that level is higher than it was in previous years. And I think you'd say the stock, the futures market right now has quite a bit of uncertainty in it because of that implied volatility level at least looks like it's been relatively high in recent times. So let me finish up here and summarize. Cattle prices will likely be at historically high levels next year for the reasons I've already mentioned. We have supplies that have not been rebuilt, and I think it's going to be an excellent research topic that I might try to attack here in the next year. But we do have these high cattle levels. Even though domestic demand has been pretty flat the last couple of years, I think we've had some restrictions on supply throughout the country, and some of that has been related to just drought and other things, I think. Price variability, as Dan Sumner mentioned, is a fact of life in this business. I don't see much evidence that it is increasing, but it certainly exists. So managing price risk is going to be really important for some producers, as it always has been important for almost all producers. Those with deep enough pockets don't need to worry about it. Those that are borrowing money and have those obligations and have a debt structure, they have to worry quite a bit more. And there is a number of price management tools that exist, including contracts, which are not perfect because one certainly wants to make sure there are things like act of God clauses and enough earnest money put down so that if someone reneges, you still have an opportunity to protect your price. Certainly, short hedging is an option that's probably more easily implemented from a standpoint of livestock producers, because production aspects are not as uncertain as in the case of especially small grains. Certainly, put options are an opportunity to protect downside risk while still being able to participate in potential upside gains. And then LRP and a variety of other insurance products that I know John Hewlett is going to talk with you about here in a few minutes, if I just give him some time. My take-home message is this. For those folks for whom pockets aren't deep enough and they need to manage their price variability, there are methods for doing it. None of them are free. I haven't found an insurance product yet that's been free, at least to me. That's number one. And number two, although I'm quite risk-averse, which you'd expect from a tenured college professor, when I see close to record high prices, if somebody asks me what should I do, I say take them. There's a reason why they're a record high, and they won't be around forever. Now, will they be around a year so you could get them without doing any price protection? Well, perhaps. I don't know. But Dan Sumner mentioned the same thing. Take advantage when you have opportunities. I will close and say John Hewlett, Duane Griffith, and I, and many others in the extension community, we often get asked a question about how can I use futures markets when prices are really low? That's when people want more education on futures markets. The bottom line is when prices are really low, you don't need the futures markets. The downside risk, you're about at the bottom, so don't worry about it. But that's when people want to start thinking about it. Here is the time when they should be thinking about it. And I will stop there, and certainly I look forward to John's comments and be available for questions. So, John, thank you very much.
Yes, Gary, I'm going to ask you one question while we're loading John Hewlett's slides up, and then ask you to stick around, and when John's finished, the two of you can answer some questions then.
Very good.
And this question was actually something you didn't touch on. There is some data out there that suggests concentration within the beef industry, and the question is it true in your opinion? And the next part, which really relates to our volatility issue, is what impact do you think that has on volatility?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be talking about this next week at the Montana Stock Growers Association as well. Certainly, there's been a fair bit of concentration in the packing industry over the last 30 years. 85% of steers and heifers are now slaughtered by four companies. The bottom line is this a good thing or a bad thing? And as an economist, you could see both. Because we have that size in that industry, you're able to produce new technologies. You're able to do a better job of meeting consumer demands, those kinds of things, and reducing transactions costs. The downside is this also provide an opportunity for some sort of collusive behavior? And, of course, the current GIPSA proposed rule on reducing contracting, what's that going to do to the industry? I think it's pretty clear. I think what you're going to see is you're telling a company that they can't do business, not only a company, but the people who sell products to that company, the cattle producers, that you can't do business the way you want to do it. So adding cost to this sort of industry is always a bad idea. The research evidence, John, is that if there is some collusive activities going on, it is very, very minor and more than offset by the good things that has happened in the industry because of that concentration.
Thank you. And Gary, we look forward to your answering some questions when John is through. But